and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the German Wings A320 airliner that crashed Tuesday in the French Alps, killing all 150 aboard, a tragedy that now appears to have been caused by the co-pilot, who apparently locked the pilot out of the cockpit, then deliberately downed the aircraft. An active airline pilot, Patrick Smith, the author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers and Reflections, joins us to discuss why and how this crash happened and what can be done to prevent further incidents like this. Then we'll speak with David Gleave, a chief investigator for Aviation Transport Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. He joins us to discuss at least 8 other similar incidents involving commercial aircraft and the downsizing of the profession of airline pilots, who have become little more than aerial bus drivers today, many carrying huge debt from flying school that, with their low salaries, barely adds up to a living wage. Then we'll look into the escalation of the civil war in Yemen with the introduction of outside forces as Saudi Arabia threatens a land invasion and airstrikes are underway by warplanes from Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, Jordan and Morocco, and naval help from Pakistan and Egypt is arriving off the port of Aden. Charles Schmitz, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies and a professor of geography at Towson University, joins us to discuss the worsening situation. Then Jack Goldstone joins us. He is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars and a professor of public policy at George Mason University, who has an article at CNN, Why Yemen Has Come Undone. We will discuss the failed U.S. policy of drone bombing Yemen from the air while ignoring social instability on the ground in a fragile state about to fail that has the youngest and fastest growing population in the region and is running out of oil and water. And joining us now is Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger and author, whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com, where he has an article, German A320 Crashed in the Alps. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Smith.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And in your article, Patrick, you point out how, as an airline pilot, how in many ways this suicide that took 149 other lives with it is a stain on your profession or stigmatizes the entire profession. This, of course, is not the first. You point out that in 1994, an off-duty FedEx pilot riding along in a cockpit jumpsuit attacked the crew of a DC-10 freighter and with a hammer and a spear gun and a PSA jet once crashed after a disgruntled employee shot both pilots. Then, of course, you have the Egypt Air crash off New York. You also have the flight from Mozambique to Angola in 2013. And then you have another one in December of 1997, traveling from Indonesia to Singapore, where it appears. And, of course, we have the mysterious Malaysian jet flight that was the last time we spoke, and that still remains a mystery. And some people think that perhaps the pilot in that case took the plane down with him. So this is not to say there's an epidemic, but there is a problem, right?
Well, you covered a lot of ground there, Ian. To back up, first of all, we don't know for sure what we're dealing with in this latest case. I mean, here it is 48 hours after the incident. And, you know, conventional wisdom has the problem nailed down, and the cause was pilot suicide, end of story. And we don't know that that's the case. So we have to wait, let the investigators do their thing, and we'll find out. Eventually, we'll get a more clear picture of what happened. Meanwhile, the incidents you listed, a couple of those, the Silk Air Singapore incident is somewhat unsolved. We have no idea what happened with the Malaysia Airlines missing Boeing 777. May or may not be related to some sort of sabotage. We don't know. Either way, you have to remember to look at this in the bigger picture, the broader context. Infrequent as air crashes are, there have been hundreds of them over the decades, and very, 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 very few of them has been due to some sort of malicious act on the part of a crew member, a pilot. So, yeah, is there a crisis? No, of course not. I understand why the public is so captivated by this, but I don't want passengers getting on their flights tomorrow sitting back and wondering, oh my God, is the pilot going to kill us all? That's where I feel hurt. I feel offended. I feel like the profession is being stigmatized somewhat by this unnecessarily. It was a tragedy, but passengers need to realize that the tens of thousands of airline pilots out there, including me, are there for their safety. We take our jobs and our professions very seriously.
Well, Patrick, in the United States, of course, this would not have happened because it's not a law so much as a rule that the airlines follow, that if the pilot leaves the cockpit, somebody else gets into the second seat, so that there's never just one person alone in the cockpit. At least that's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
Well, one thing that jumped out at me is that there was only one individual in the cockpit of the German Wings aircraft. In the U.S., if a pilot comes out for physiological reasons, somebody else goes into the cockpit to take that person's place, usually a cabin crew member. So there are always at least two people up front. I had presumed that was the protocol in the EU as well, but apparently not. And I think you're probably going to see that procedure changed regardless of the outcome of this incident.
And, of course, the measures taken after 9/11 to secure cockpit doors appear to have sort of backfired in this case. Is there any way to have a cockpit door that's secure from a terrorist at the same time would prevent a situation, what appears to have happened with this German Wings flight, where the pilot went out but then tried to get back in and couldn't, was banging on the door?
Yeah, that's a great point, Ian. And this is something that's been debated in the past and will be debated again. The idea of these impenetrable cockpit doors, it was a bit of a reflex, knee-jerk reaction after September 11th, but now we're having we're seeing the possibility of the bad guys locking out the good guys, so to speak. So we may have to revisit this.
And in terms of psychological testing, it's a law in the U.S. that you can't, if you apply for a job, you can't be psychologically tested or screened before you get the job. Only once you get the job. And I take it that all airline pilots go through some kind of a medical examination with an FAA-certified physician once a year. Is that correct?
Well, some carriers will, upon hiring a pilot, require that pilot to undergo a psychological evaluation after being offered the job, sort of a conditional offer of employment, subject to the evaluation working out okay. Not all carriers do that, but meanwhile, all pilots are subject to medical exams either once or twice a year, depending. And a psychological evaluation is a component of that checkup, but it's not a psych exam per se. But at some point, Ian, there has to be a presumption here. When I go to work, I have to presume that the pilot sitting next to me is a professional with everybody's safety and well-being in mind, and then passengers have to realize the same thing. Like I said a minute ago, that of all the tens of thousands of pilots out there, and I'm one of them, we're there, we're highly trained professionals, and we're there to do our jobs and not to kill people. And, this sort of thing... if indeed this is what happened, it could happen in any line of work, any profession. And pilots are human beings too, and no line of work is going to be bulletproof against every human weakness, and we can't engineer out this possibility completely. And further to that, all the medical testing in the world isn't going to preclude every potential breakdown or malicious act. At a certain point, you just have to trust that the people in whose hands you put your fate to go fly in an airplane, are there to do their job.
So in this case, assuming it is as is being assumed here, that the co-pilot, once the pilot went to go to the bathroom or whatever reason he left the cockpit, locked the door and then took the plane into a dive, and killed himself along with 149 innocent souls. the assumption is that perhaps, if this is true, of course, which it seems to be the case, that somebody missed the psychological screening here, that this is somebody that was troubled. Is there any protocol that you can think of that could have screened this out? And I understand this pilot didn't have a lot of experience. He was 28 years old. I think he had, hundreds of hours, as opposed to, I guess you've got thousands of hours, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did have a, at least by American standards, a very low amount of flight time. But that's a separate conversation and isn't necessarily indicative of anything. I don't see that as especially relevant to what happened. Was there a way to pre-screen away this pilot's act? Maybe not. As I said a minute ago, there's no way to totally engineer out, to test out this possibility. I mean, I have a feeling that had this pilot been evaluated 2 days ago, he probably would have been cleared to fly. It's the kind of thing you can't predict, and that every once in a while, very rarely, but once in a while pops up.
Well, at least the one thing that we know that could have been done and should have been done, and that is the practice that exists with American airlines, with airliners in America, I should say, that when a pilot leaves the cockpit, some other crew member takes his place, so that there's always two people on the flight deck.
That's correct. The U.S. and Canada, that is the protocol, and other countries, too. In Europe, I'm not sure exactly what the rules are. It may vary carrier to carrier. It might not be an across-the-board regulatory thing. But either way, I'm all but certain that that policy will be revised.
Well, just in closing, Patrick Smith, I know you've been besieged with calls, and this is obviously a terrible thing for your profession. But just in closing, your main concern is that this doesn't stigmatize your profession and doesn't deter people from flying. And it is, of course, a monstrous assumption that, you know, we always look upon pilots and we put our lives in their hands, don't we? That's the reality as opposed to the nightmare.
Indeed. And as tragic as this was, as horrific as it was, however, it was, for lack of a better term, a freak event and something extraordinarily unusual. And I really want the public to realize that, and also to just look at air safety generally in the broader perspective. It seems that we've had a lot of crashes lately. And in one sense, that's true. But when you look at it historically, and in the bigger picture, the accident rate has actually come way, way down in recent years compared to how it was in the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, when we would have multiple large-scale air disasters every single year. And we don't see that anymore, but when we do see them, there's a tendency to really fixate on them.
Well, Patrick Smith, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Anytime, Ian. Thank you.
And again, we've been speaking with Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author, whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com, where he has an article, German Wings A320 Crashes in the Alps. And joining us now is David Gleave, who is the chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gleave.
Good to be back.
And we last spoke, of course, with the disappeared Malaysian airliner, and that still remains a mystery. And a lot of speculation is that the pilot or co-pilot or somebody on the flight deck may have caused the plane's disappearance. But there have been at least, I think, 6 to 8 incidents that I could list. And the Federal Aviation Administration here in the United States have said that 24 American pilots over the last 20 years have killed themselves while flying planes. And if you add to that the number of the Japan Airlines flight back in 82, the Royal Air Maroc flight back in 94, Silk Air back in 97, Air Botswana in 1999, the Egypt Air in 1999, and the Mozambique Air crash in November of 2013. And then, of course, you had a FedEx pilot in 1944 attacking the crew of a DC-10 freighter with a hammer and a spear gun. And then the PSA, a California airliner, lost one of its jets after a disgruntled employee shot both pilots. So There's a sort of history here, isn't there? It may be not amount to a lot statistically, but it's certainly enough to alarm one.
Yes, I mean, that's a very comprehensive list of the sort of events that we've been suffering over the last 30 years or so. I think what's happening these days is that we've removed a lot of the other causes, so we're beginning to see this pop up as a once-a-year event at the moment. I think it's a bit of a statistical blip. It's slightly less than that, but the last 3 years, we think we've lost three aeroplanes this type of cause. And there's a lot of focus on it now with media attention and things like that. So because of the pressure of the 24-hour social networking and things like that, everybody can get a comment. We can get much better pictures of crash sites through to the world media much more often rather than just a few column inches in a newspaper and a picture of the wreckage in a professional publication to be read by pilots in the aviation industry. So although people get worried about it, I still think the risk is very, very low indeed. And certainly as the number of flights increase, then we're not really increasing the rate that this particular accident happens at.
Well, already apparently authorities in Britain and other European countries have moved to adopt a policy which US airlines have and Canadian airlines have, which is when a pilot leaves the cockpit, another crew member takes his place, so that there's always two people in the cockpit.
Yeah, that's certainly a difference in the regulations, and it was a practice that some airlines have. Some do it only in long haul, some do it in long haul and short haul. But I think, obviously, it's beginning to indicate some airlines are saying they're doing it voluntarily from tomorrow morning. Others will probably follow by regulation. I think it's going to affect the low-cost carriers because that's going to mean that one of their relatively few cabin service members is going to be taken out of operation for a few minutes of flight and reduce the in-flight sales.
And this was a low-cost carrier, right? German Wings?
Yes, it would be sort of more of a medium type of carrier. It's basically, it's taken over all the regional routes so from Lufthansa. So any flight that goes in and out of Frankfurt or Munich, the two big towns, there are flown by the mainline Lufthansa. And then everything else, apart from one or two little obscure transatlantic flights, anything that flies around Europe in that area with the relatively small aeroplanes, of say 200 seaters and below, across Europe, those are flown by this particular, we could call it a regional airline, I think would be a better description, because it does really give you some of the benefits of Lufthansa rather than being the very low-cost Southwest Airlines equivalent.
And again, I'm speaking with David Glebe, who's a Chief Investigator for Aviation Safety Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. Well, my understanding, David, is that the Israeli airline, El Al, get around this problem that was perhaps the reason for this crash of the German Wings airliner. And that is they have two cockpit doors, so that if the pilot leaves the flight deck to go to the bathroom, for example, there's a second door. So is that a way to solve this problem?
It's certainly one option, and the freighter aircraft have everything built into the cockpits at the front end as well. It's an option. Just having the two pilots there isn't necessarily the total answer, because we have had, as you, in your list, one pilot being attacked by another person on the flight deck themselves. We have the possibility of armed pilots also within the United States. And we also have one implement on the flight deck that's been used to kill flight crew members before as well. So I think we're probably going to have to sit down as an industry and really kick the ball around here and see what we can come up with. And we have to bear in mind that after 9/11, the regulations were written on the basis that a terrorist act not only kills those on board the aeroplane, but can have massive third-party consequences on the ground. And therefore, to have one, let's call it suicide for sake of argument, is less bad for the overall population than to have one terrorist hijack, which is then considered to be a flying bomb. So we need to get the balance right of probabilities and risk and discuss it openly in the industry to see where we go from here.
Well, clearly making these terrorist-proof cockpit doors as a result of 9/11 has backfired in this case, right? There was no way for this pilot who was banging on the door to get back in.
Not in the short space of time for the descent, no. And the implements available in the cabin have been reduced, although in larger aeroplanes there are still some that can be used. In general, there was no way that this pilot could get in and have any effective control whatsoever.
So at the moment, of course, all of the families of the victims, or many of the families of the victims, I should say, have gone up to the French Alps, including the family of the co-pilot. And apparently they've had to segregate that family out. You've been following all of the press conferences and investigations. I take it that at this point, David Glebe, the version that we've heard, that it's the co-pilot's, in effect, committed suicide and took down 149 other souls with him. That seems to be pretty much the case, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, everything that's been said is consistent with the type of investigation for suicide that I've worked on before. Everything was as expected. The briefing was very comprehensive. The French investigators have done an incredible job decoding it. I mean, it'll take quite a while for them to tie everything up and present it in reports that stand up to scrutiny from everybody. But at the end of the day, they've gone through the transcript and they've said that everything was fine up to a certain point where one pilot leaves to go to the bathroom. And then after that, there is a series of inputs into the flight control system to descend the aeroplane relatively rapidly, not consistent with just reducing engine power, anything like that, which have led to a descent, there's no significant change of heading appears or anything like that, and there's no interference really with the navigation system to turn it away towards Marseille Airport if there was an engine fire, communication with air traffic control. Things will get ratified when we get the data recorder as well, but everything is entirely consistent and beyond reasonable doubt for a lawyer to actually stand up in public and say this, to the stage where we're looking at the most likely cause at the moment of some form of deliberate act by one of the pilots.
And just in closing, David Glebe, is there anything that can be done to pre-screen people that have clearly this psychological disposition, although it may not manifest itself? That seems to be the problem in screening.
I think there's two things here. First of all, there's a screening that if somebody's predisposed to do this sort of thing from an early age, then we may be able to find that in background checks. I think the other thing is that, you know, some of these guys are quite young. He's still 26. He may have led a relatively sheltered life. We don't know. We'll find out. But we need to be able to talk about things, that if we have a mental illness of some form or other, if we feel depressed, not quite up to going to work, that really we can call in sick without any penalty from the airline, without being fined, to know that these guys who may have paid an awful lot of money for their training and be on relatively low pay can still live and survive, and they just need to say, hey, I need a week off. I'm completely tired because of the schedule, or I've had a personal grief with a loss of family member, or I've had a relationship breakup. We need to be able to discuss that full, frank, and openly within the industry and not have any penalties applied to the people who are flying the aeroplane and say, I'm not fit to go to work today.
But is this the result of what seems to have happened over the last few decades, where airline pilots used to be highly paid professionals and they've essentially been reduced down to sort of aerial bus drivers?
Yes, I mean, the glamour has gone from the job, but basically, rather than being selected at 18 or 21 after college or something like that and put through a full scholarship for your flying training, or coming out of the military with a pension and paying for your own flying training, you have to pay for everything yourself. So here in Europe, you can easily run up a debt of $200,000 for your flying training, and that will get you possibly a position in an airline. You may even have to pay the airline for your first 500 hours of experience before you can get a real job. And so some of the penalties can be quite low pay for the first few years, much like the commuter airlines in the United States. So you don't necessarily get a very good salary. You may have an awful lot of debt loaded up upon you, which wasn't present a few years ago.
Well, David Glebe, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Glebe, who's the Chief Investigator for Aviation Safety Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the escalation of the civil war in Yemen with the introduction of outside forces.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Grease your pride, telling lies that, you're not on. Faith in prayers will make you see your bones.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Schmitz.
Thank you.
And Charles, it would seem that this very fragile country is about to become this fragile state is about to become a failed state with the introduction of outside forces and a full-scale civil war. Is that your reading on it?
Yeah, certainly the state is not working, but the state hasn't been working for some time. During the transition period, one of the reasons that the Houthi were able to come to power was the failures of the transitional government under Hadi from 2012 to 2014. The situation has definitely worsened. The state is hardly functioning, and the outside intervention is certainly going to make things more difficult.
And Hadi has fled to Saudi Arabia, has he not?
Yeah, he has. Officially, he's on his way to the Arab Summit League meeting. I think it was just a way to get Hadi, who represents the opposition to the Houthis in Yemen, out of harm's way, because the Battle of Aden is still going on. It's kind of gone back and forth. The Houthis penetrated this morning into Aden. They were pushed back out again, but there's reports that they're making another attempt to push in. So I think they were getting Hadi out of harm's way into Saudi Arabia.
Well, apparently Saudi Arabia has organized this coalition of air forces from the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Jordan, Morocco, and Sudan, and naval ships are arriving off Aden from Pakistan and Egypt. So it looks as though the Sunni nations are ganging up on the Houthi Shiites.
Yeah, I would characterize it slightly differently. I mean, the Houthi are very much a domestic Yemeni force. Their power is based on their relations inside of Yemen. If the Iranians go away, the Houthi will stay. The Houthi do not do the Iranian bidding. Of course, they do receive Iranian support and helps them to some degree, but really their sources of power are domestic. And I would say this so-called Sunni coalition is not so much a Sunni coalition as a whole bunch of nations that are a little bit beholden to Saudi Arabia. I'm sure the deal is being cut to get them to represent. This is mainly a Saudi offensive, and they're trying to make it look like a wider one. But it's really a Saudi and Egypt, which is very much allied with Saudi Arabia right now, grateful for the support in Sisi's coming to power. Are helping out on this thing, but it's mostly, this is the Saudi Arabian lead, and they're supplying the bulk of the forces, they're really the instigators of this.
Well, it would seem though that and you've pointed out that the Shia Iranian connection to the Houthis, which is a sort of branch of Shiism, it has been I think regularly exaggerated in the press, and it does seem that the Saudis are quite nervous at the moment about the negotiations between the U.S. and the P5 plus one plus Iran.
Yes, I would say that the issue is not so much Sunni-Shi as it is Iranian-Saudi. And it's because the Saudis are attacking ISIS, and the ISIS are Sunni. And in the civil war in 1962 in Yemen, it was the Saudis supporting these same guys, the Shi in the north. So it's not really sectarian, it's state interests in that point. And as far as the negotiations in Iran, I mean, everybody sort of asked about the timing of this, whether the Saudis are trying to disrupt the negotiations. The Iranians stated explicitly that it would have no effect on the negotiations. And I think the timing was more to save Hadi, because the Houthi were about to take Hadi in Aden, and they moved quickly to try and keep Hadi, because Hadi's important symbolically to sort of bring all of the disparate forces together that oppose the Houthi. Because there's no real central force that opposes the Houthi. There's a whole lot of different ones, and they seem to be able to rally around Hadi.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Spitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Spitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationships with other nations in the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. So what explains the extraordinary military effectiveness of this Houthi tribe and these tribesmen? You see them running around with AK-47s, wearing sandals.
Yes, well, that's standard equipment in Yemen. People are sometimes surprised by that. I certainly was, to see people running, you know, men running around with sort of skirts on and sandals and an AK-47 and going off to battle. It didn't seem very, very effective. We should emphasize that the real military capabilities of the Houthis come more from their partner Ali Abdullah Saleh, that he's the one that commands the armed forces, the loyalty in the armed forces, and it's the armed forces that are key to this, the regular forces that are trained and then are equipped. The Houthi militias, yes, they play some role, but they're not nearly as effective as the real armed forces, which Saleh seems to control a lot of them.
But he's obviously aligned with the Houthis, and yet his protege is the guy that's fled to Saudi Arabia.
Well, no, Hadi was never his protege. Hadi was vice president because...
Oh, that's right. He wanted his son to be put in there, didn't he?
That's right. Hadi was there because he was a nobody. I mean, Ali Abdullah Saleh surrounded himself. He appointed ministers who were very beholden to him, that didn't have any power base on their own. That's exactly what Hadi was. Hadi was as despised as anybody else to end up being president of Yemen in the transition period. I would say that the one interesting statement that came out today was that Saleh, his party, the General People's Congress, called for a cessation of the air raids, but also cessation of the Houthi advance on Aden. So he seems to be now kind of distancing himself a little bit from the Houthi and positioning himself for the negotiations that are inevitably going to come for a political solution to this.
Well, my understanding is that Saleh, the former leader who was deposed and replaced by Hadi, and he was wounded in an attack on the palace, that he stole something like up to $60 billion. I mean, that's an enormous figure for an incredibly poor country that's running out of oil and water.
Yeah, I've seen various figures. The one in Forbes was $32 billion. Just to put it in perspective, the GDP, the normal GDP of the Yemeni economy is about $38 billion. So it's close to 1 year's output of the total economy he had made off with. And yes, this is mostly through the last two decades in which Yemen was exporting oil. It was being siphoned off and channeled into, some of it was being channeled into his personal accounts, which he... some of it's in Yemen, but a lot of it's dispersed in various investments all over the Arab world.
And yet this is a guy we considered an ally, a reliable, stalwart ally in our war on terror and our fight against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Didn't anybody on our side notice that he was a kleptocrat?
Well, that's one of the issues with the Obama strategy of, you know, using the drones and then partnering with local forces. It very much depends upon the political conditions in the country, whether that strategy is going to work or not. And Saleh was an unreliable, we could say he was an unreliable partner. Hadi was at least publicly, much more straightforward. I mean, he said that drones are good, that they're more accurate than other means of attacking Al-Qaeda. But Hadi wasn't nearly as didn't have as much control over the country as Salik did.
He didn't have $40 billion to bribe people with, right? I mean,
right.
That's just so extraordinary, isn't it? And of course, this is the poorest, one of the poorest countries in the region, with the fastest growing populations, and as I mentioned earlier, it's running out of both oil and water.
Yes, that's one of the stories. That's the real crisis. Is that it seems that there's a few powerful men in Saudi Arabia and inside of Yemen that are willing to destroy an entire country for their own power. That's the real extraordinary story here, because Yemen is suffering. This is the period in Yemen that you really needed to have an effective state to plan transition of the economy away from oil to a more diversified economy, a more stable economy that needed a stable state, and they're getting exactly the opposite as, the opposing sides and the outside people, fight it out over politics.
And it looks as though it's the outside forces are going to escalate. We've got the possibility of Egypt. In fact, they've said they're going to send troops to fight the Houthis. They're sending naval ships, and because Egypt has a history of a long and somewhat futile military expedition into Yemen. What, in the 1960s, wasn't it?
Yes, it's called Egypt's Vietnam, because they got beat up badly in Yemen. The Saudis have about 150,000 troops amassed on the eastern border to go in, and they may at some point go in and be part of the eastern desert, which is mostly deserted. It's quite sparsely populated. But if they ever tried to go into the Yemeni highlands, I mean, I think there would be resistance. They would unify resistance against foreign intervention, and they also would have a very difficult time.
And they haven't been tested, have they? The Saudi military. They spend more money than God on weapons. The country is the most highly armed per capita, with the most sophisticated U.S. And European weapons, and I guess some Russian weapons on the planet. But they've never been tested.
That's right, and I think the Saudis are a little nervous about testing them. They did perform well last night, and tonight, I mean, the Air Force did do targeted bombings, and they hit many different targets, and they were quite effective against them. I think the United States says they were supporting logistically intelligence. I think the United States gave them a lot of the information on the on exactly where to hit. They were trying to degrade the Air Force, any possibility of air power, and they did a quite effective job, I think. But it's true, the Saudis are very nervous about their military.
And how's this playing in Saudi Arabia? Do we have any idea whether domestically what's going on?
The Saudis are fairly united that Iran is a threat, and that the Houthis represent an Iranian arm inside of Yemen. At least that's sort of those that have any power to speak in Saudi society. That's what they're saying. Yes.
Well, that's just going to further isolate the Shia population in Iran. They're sounding like they're more and more treating them as a fifth column as well.
Yes, within Saudi Arabia, you mean? Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I mean, they have their own problems, and they don't seem willing to solve them. That's true. It's absolutely true.
Well, how do you see this thing working out then, Charles Smith? I mean, it's poised a country that's, as I said, is a fragile state, about to be a failed state. Outside intervention could push it further into that state. Is there any way out?
Well, the way out is going to eventually be some political settlement. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the irony of this is that they were close to a political settlement last week. The Houthi came into Sana'a last September, and they came into Sana'a saying that they were going to effectively put into place the outcomes of the national dialogue that had taken place, in 2012, 2013. And they at one point they said, well, we need new government institutions, and that's the point where everybody says, well, this is actually a coup rather than, you know, implementing the outcomes of the national dialogue. But the political leaders kept, of all parties, kept talking, and they had agreed on a 5-member presidential council, and they agreed on adding members to the existing parliament to balance out the political forces in the parliament, because the parliament is entirely the former president, Ali Bialystok's party. The only disagreement was who should be the head of this presidential council. And the opposition had wanted Hadi to be it, and Ali Bialystok and the Houthi had said they would accept a southerner, but not Hadi, a different southerner. I mean, that's pretty close.
Right.
I think what's going to happen now, there's going to be some back and forth, and, you know, they're going to see what the military situation is on the ground. But eventually, you know, this will set the stage for a set of negotiations in which we will eventually put the country back together again. But the question is, you know, how much damage is going to be done in the meantime?
Well, Charles Schmitz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
So you're quite welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. He's a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. And we're going to take a brief station break and come back and discuss the failed U.S. policy of drone bombing Yemen from the air while ignoring social instability on the ground. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jack Goldstone, who's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a Hazel Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. He's the author of Revolution and Rebellion in the Early Modern World, Why Europe and the Rise of the West in World History. And he has an article at CNN, Why Yemen Has Come Undone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Goldstone.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
And I guess we haven't been watching the ball or minding the store here. We've been focused on Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and not focused on this poor, ill-governed country that is falling apart.
Unfortunately, because of our desire not to repeat the mistakes we've made with state building in Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States has decided to stop paying attention when states fall apart. But unfortunately, it keeps happening, and it's going to continue to keep hurting us.
And this country used to be two countries, and is it likely to become two countries again, do you think?
It's possible, although in the past it was a northern and southern portion, where the southern was more influenced by the British colonial experience around the southern port city of Aden. Now it seems to be breaking more into east and west, but frankly, the fight is largely among different tribal groups and different religious sectarian groups, and it's probably too early to know what's going to happen. There's fissures all through the country at the moment, although the Houthis do, for the moment, seem to be in charge.
And in your article at CNN, Jack Goldstone, Why Yemen Has Come Undone, you talk about it's been plagued by personalist government. I guess nobody more than the deposed ex-president Saleh fits that bill, and he's apparently in collusion with the Houthis.
It's quite a sad story, yes. By personalist government, I mean a government in which things have come to rotate so much around one individual that politics becomes very factional, There's no good mechanism for succession. There are no good institutions that have been built up to mediate conflicts or preserve stability. It really kind of all depends on one person. And if that one person loses popularity or loses the support of the military, which is what happened to Saleh, the whole thing tends to fall down. And the United States tried to move him gently aside, replace him with President Hadi. But it was more like a stage play. It didn't really work. Saleh kind of withdrew while plotting how to return. Hadi never really established his authority. And in the meantime, the regional rebellions, such as that of the unhappy Houthis, who'd been, they felt excluded because of their religious and tribal affiliation, they demanded attention. And they marched on the capital eventually and were able to take it because the government, after Saleh left, was so tied up with its own internal fighting. And we paid no attention to all of that because we said the only thing that matters to us is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and so we were focusing our drone attacks on them, and meanwhile the whole country was falling apart.
But when you talk about the army, what army? It seems to have fallen apart too, right? The Houthis have taken the airport at Aden on the Red Sea, on the Indian Ocean, and the Saudis have now started to bomb them.
Well, remember, an army is only as good as it has something to fight for. If you simply put a lot of people in tanks and on bases, but they have nothing that they believe in and nothing that they want to fight for, then they will leave when they are attacked. We saw this happen in Mosul, where the Sunni military detachments that were supposed to protect Mosul when ISIS came a-calling, they also melted away because they didn't feel that the Iraqi government that employed them was something they wanted to fight and die for. And this is the same thing with Yemen. Once President Saleh left, the military was not sure what they were fighting for any longer and ceased to become an effective force.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Goldstone, who's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a Hazel Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. He has an article at CNN, Why Yemen Has Come Undone. But apparently, the military equipment, the armies may have disintegrated and factionalized, but the equipment seems to have been up for grabs, and various factions, not just the Houthis, seem to be grabbing this military equipment. An al-Qaeda-affiliated group grabbed a whole base recently, and the U.S. just pulled its special forces out. So this is beginning to look like it could become a heavily armed failed state, which my understanding is our worst nightmare.
You're exactly right. It is a worst nightmare. It could become the worst of the worst if Saudi Arabia follows through on its threat to actually invade Yemen with land troops and create a land war. That would put the Saudis directly at war with a group that is being supported by Iran. It is a situation that we can only hope will continue to be limited to conflict within Yemen and not spill into a broader regional conflict. But the danger of that is large. The volume of heavy weapons, including aircraft that have been captured by various factions, is quite substantial. And so we are looking at a failed state with scope for jihadist takeover of at least part of the territory, and with various groups, including jihadists and pro-Iranian rebels, capturing major military hardware. It's something we should have tried much harder to prevent.
Well, but you have to add to that what you just said, surely, Jack Goldstone, that the Saudi Arabians are... Their ambassador here in the U.S. has gone on television and said that not just the Saudis, but the Gulf, hundreds of aircraft are being deployed. Military equipment is going down to the south. They're talking about threatening boots on the ground, a land war. They're trying to bring the Egyptians in. Egypt already has a sorry history of military involvement in Yemen. This looks like it's escalating.
It does look like it's escalating. This is why I've said, you know, the one thing that America can perhaps try and do is mediate some kind of restraint or containment before it becomes a full-fledged regional war. But our reputation, in a sense, is not good because the Saudis already look at America as having been weak in Syria, as having been irresolute in Libya, and they are inclined for that reason to feel that they may have to take things into their own hands. I was frankly a bit surprised when the Saudis mentioned they might send ground troops. That boots on the ground is a big escalation for them. But, of course, their worst nightmare is a Shiite state right on their border.
And but the Houthi, the Iran connection to the Houthis has seems to have always been somewhat exaggerated. I'm not even sure what kind of Iranian presence there is. Isn't this a homegrown rebellion?
It is indeed, and I think you're quite right to point that out. For the most part, the fighting between the Houthis and other groups has revolved around these factional contests for who will control the presidency and who will control the capital. Iran has given some support to the Houthi as co-religionists. I've heard some people say they don't think that the Houthis would have been sufficiently well organized or well disciplined to take the capital city of Sana'a unless they'd had some drill instruction and oversight from Iran. But I don't know that to be a fact. It's just speculation based on the kind of sudden increase in the effectiveness of the Houthis as a fighting force. Remember, they'd been staging a rebellion that was confined to the corner of Yemen for many years before they suddenly broke out. What I will say is the Saudis perceive this as a substantial sectarian threat linked to Iran's effort to expand and project its power. And if the Saudis perceive that and act on it, that will be what matters.
But are the Saudis perhaps not seeing things straight because they're already paranoid about this deal that the U.S. and the P5 plus one are doing with Iran? And this must be adding to their paranoia.
Well, this is where the United States needs to really step up its diplomacy with the Saudis. A deal that actually does make it more difficult for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons is something that the Saudi government would welcome. Their fear is that America will sign a deal with weak enforcement or weak constraints that allows Iran to progress toward that weapon. So we have to make it very clear to our friends in Riyadh that we want the same thing they want. We want to prevent Iran from any ability to acquire nuclear weapons. So that needs to be smoothed over because you're correct. The Saudis are paranoid and they fear that, as I've said, they see the U.S. as weak. They're afraid that we will let them down in this regard, just as they perceive us to have let down the Egyptian regime and just as they've perceived us to be weak in a number of other areas.
And, of course, the Saudi position that you just outlined, Jack Goldstone, is exactly the same as Netanyahu of Israel's position vis-a-vis these talks with Iran.
I think everyone wants the talks to create a strong barrier to Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapon. The differences among friends are over whether a particular language or set of conditions will provide such a barrier. Of course, Netanyahu's position is a bit extreme. He believes that Iran cannot be trusted to abide by any agreement, no matter how binding or powerful it appears. I think that's an extreme position and not a productive one. but certainly, there is anxiety about Iran's spreading influence in the region, particularly in Iraq, somewhat in Afghanistan. They're certainly concerned that Iran has been supporting the Syrian regime, which has been disastrous in its treatment of its own people. And so I quite understand the anxieties of countries in the region. Any further expansion of Iran's power looks threatening. You have to recall when Bahrain had its 2011 uprising, its counterpart in the Arab Spring, I didn't myself think that a very small island nation that was already a strong ally of the United States could pose a threat to Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis were quite concerned that this popular uprising could lead to a Shia government of a small country on their doorstep, and they acted very quickly to support the Sunni ruler and make sure that there was no threat of that change in the character of the government of Bahrain occurring. And I'm sure they view Yemen as a order of magnitude bigger risk than Bahrain.
Well, but we haven't really seen this. I mean, the Saudis have bought enormous amounts of military hardware, and they had a recent skirmish on the border with the so-called or self-proclaimed Islamic State, which killed a Saudi general. Is it possible that if they do launch full-scale military attacks, and they're now launching airstrikes, but the airstrikes don't seem to be particularly targeted in any way that, I don't even know what you can target in such a chaotic situation. But what happens if they do send in boots on the ground, send in a land invasion? Could they prove to be a paper tiger?
It's difficult to say. We've not observed the Saudi ground troops in combat operations, just except for dealing with threats inside Saudi Arabia, where they have been very effective. We haven't seen the Saudi military try and project its force against a foreign foe. That's, of course, we've been grateful for that, but now I'm not so sure that we know what to expect. Almost any army has to learn and go through adjustment once they enter the field of battle. This has been true of the Americans when we entered the Middle East and Iraq. It was true in many other cases. So I wouldn't expect kind of quick, instant success, even if Saudi Arabia brings its boots on the ground into play. It's very likely that they will create a situation where perhaps all Yemenis might unite against the Saudi foreign invaders, just as we found that kind of resentment against American troops when we tried to support what we hoped would be a better outcome in Iraq. It's just very hard to put a failing state together from the outside. Efforts in Somalia have failed. Efforts in Afghanistan have failed. So I think Yemen has reached the point at which we're going to see some years of conflict, and the Yemenis will have to decide how to rebuild their state. I only hope they can do so without a regional war arising as a result.
Well, Jack Goldstone, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. I'm sorry the topic is so distressing.
Well, it looks like it's going to get worse, and I think we'll have to revisit you.
So, all right. I'll be happy to talk to you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Jack Goldstone, who's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a Hazel Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. He has an article at CNN, Why Yemen Has Come Undone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.